In the last year or so, the discussions of tunnels under the sands of Egypt has really gained in popularity, and the biggest reason for that would be those two Italian guys that have been doing a bunch of work. Not those two Italian guys, these two Italian guys. They're the ones that have done the synthetic aperture radar work over above the Giza Plateau and in other areas, and have claimed to have detected some pretty amazing structures underneath. Now, in the words of Christopher Dunn, this is almost too good to be true, so he's going to be a little skeptical, and I've tended to be pretty skeptical on this as well. But what's very interesting when you look into this is it's not just Edgar Cayce who said that there were tunnels under the Giza Plateau. It's not just the psychics, which those of you who've watched me a lot will know that I'm a little slow to, you know, put a lot of credence in psychics. But we also have historians, over and over and over again, not just in the area of the Giza Plateau, but all over Egypt, they discuss huge tunnel networks under the sands. So let's talk about these for real. Let's just discuss what these guys actually claim to have seen thousands of years ago. Hi, my name is Dan, and welcome to Dedunking. If you go back 2,500 years, the pyramids were still considered to have been ancient, and that's when Herodotus claims to have visited Egypt and says that what he wrote down was accurate, what he really saw. And the reason I say says, you know, historians really, they don't like Herodotus a whole lot. I mean, they do, but they don't. They consider him to be somewhat accurate and somewhat not. They don't put him in the same camp as, like, Nostradamus, but maybe something like Mike Judge when he did Idiocracy. They give him a little bit of credence, but they don't think he's completely perfect. So, anyway, we can talk about this all we want. Let's just hear what Herodotus had to say. Moreover, they resolved to preserve the memory of their names by some joint enterprise. And having so resolved, they made a labyrinth, a little way beyond the Lake Moeris, and near the place called the City of Crocodiles. I myself have seen it, and indeed no words can tell its wonders. Were all that the Greeks have builded and wrought added together, the whole would be seen to be a matter of less labor and cost less than was this labyrinth, albeit the temples at Ephesus and Samos are noteworthy buildings. Though the pyramids were greater than words can tell, and each of them a match for the many monuments built by the Greeks, this maze surpasses even the pyramids. It has 12 roofed courts, with doors over against each other, 6 face the north and 6 face the south, in 2 continuous lines, all within 1 outer wall. There are also double sets of chambers, 3,000 altogether, 1,500 above and the same number underground. We ourselves viewed those that are above ground, and speak of what we have seen, of the underground chambers we were only told. The Egyptian wardens would by no means show them, these being, they said, the burial vaults of the kings who first built this labyrinth, and one of the sacred crocodiles. Thus we can only speak from hearsay of the lower chambers, the upper we saw for ourselves, and they are the creations greater than human. The outlets of the chambers and the mazy passages hither through the courts were an unending marvel to us as we passed from court to apartment and from apartment to colonnade, from colonnade again to more chambers and then into even yet more courts. Over all of this is a roof made of stone like the walls, and the walls are covered in carven figures, and every court is set round with pillars of white stone most exactly fitted together. Hard by the corner where the labyrinth ends, there stands a pyramid 40 fathoms high, whereon great figures are carved. A passage has been made into this underground. This is far more in line with the findings of the Khafre Research Project than it is with mainstream Egyptology. Now, if you're not aware, the Khafre Research Project uses synthetic aperture radar and changes in the topography to extrapolate what lies beneath the soil using computer software that's proprietary to them. I've done a whole video on it. If you're interested, you can check that out there. What's important here is that the words of Herodotus do seem to back that up, and he's not alone. He's got other people there, too. One of them was named Didorotus Siculus, and I'm sure I pronounced that perfect, but let's hear what he had to say. The smaller bears no inscription, but has steps cut into one side. And though the two kings built the pyramids to serve as their tombs, in the event neither of them was buried in them, for the multitudes, because of the hardships which they had endured in the building of them, and the many cruel and violent acts of these kings, were filled with anger against those who had caused their sufferings and openly threatened to tear their bodies asunder and cast them in despite out of the tombs. Consequently, each ruler, when dying, enjoined upon his kinsmen to bury his body secretly in an unmarked place. Well, if the pyramids weren't tombs, and instead you had bodies buried underground, It does imply you would have some sort of tunnels underground to access those bodies and probably to confound would-be grave robbers. But that also begs a question, then what were the pyramids for? And this is something I've covered in the past, and I might be overhauling this position here in the near future. I learn as things go on, crazily enough. But anyway, if you're interested, that's the video to check out for now. The Egyptians called Giza Rostau, which translates to Mouth of the Passages or Door to the Underworld, and is also the name they used for the Duat, the region of the sky they hoped to ascend to after resurrection. A fact that supports both the idea of a labyrinth under the Giza Plateau and the ideas that I had for the use of the pyramids that I mentioned earlier. And I want to say it again, the Egyptian name for the Giza Plateau was Mouth of the Passages, and they equated it with their Duat, the underworld, their heaven. All right, so this does, this is speculative, but it also heavily points to tunnels underneath the place. Not a crazy idea. And we also have a lot of speculation when you look at the dream stela in front of the Sphinx. It does look like there's a maze underneath the dang lions. I mean, that doesn't look crazy, and it's not an insane idea to think such a thing. Edgar Cayce wasn't the only guy who spoke of stuff underneath that area of Egypt. As a matter of fact, not only did Diodorus Strabolipolipolis, but there was a dude named Strabo that spoke about it as well. We have here also the labyrinth, a work equal to the pyramids, and adjoining to it the tomb of the king who constructed the labyrinth. After proceeding beyond the first entrance of the canal, about 30 or 40 stadia, there is a temple-shaped plain with a village and a large palace composed of as many palaces as there were former nomes. There are an equal number of halls surrounded by pillars and contiguous to one another, all in one line and forming one building, like a long wall having the hall in front of it. The entrances in the halls are opposite to the wall. In front of the entrances, there are long and numerous covered ways, with winding passages communicating with each other, so that no stranger could find his way into the hallways or out of them without a guide. The most surprising circumstance is that the roof of these dwellings consists of a single stone each, and that the covered ways through their whole range were roofed in the same manner with a single slab of stone of extraordinary size, without the intermixture of timber or of any other material. On ascending the roof, which is not of great height, for it consists of only a single story, there must be seen a stone field, thus composed of stones. Descending again and looking into the hallways, these may be seen in a line supported by 27 pillars, each consisting of a single stone. These walls are also constructed of stones not inferior in size to these. At the end of this building, which occupies more than a stadium, is a tomb, which is a quadrangular pyramid, each side of which is about four plethora in length and of equal height. The name of the person buried there is Amandes. They built, it is said, this number of halls because it was the custom for the gnomes to assemble there together according to their rank, with their own priests and priestesses, for the purpose of performing sacrifices and making offerings to the gods, and administering justice in matters of great importance. Now, the labyrinth was said to be located near the ancient site of Hawara, which is about 70 miles from Giza. And according to Herodotus, it was near there, but about 3 miles away at the place called the City of Crocodiles. Now, both of these are near the Fayum Oasis, but this basically implies there was either a huge network of tunnels. These accounts are slightly wrong, or it's possible that all of Egypt or huge chunks of Egypt were connected by these sorts of things. It's quite possible that the ancient myths were true in this case, and that's kind of crazy, but the ancient myths do keep going. For example, there's the Book of Fayum, which is one of the last, if not the last, Egyptian text dealing with their religion that was written in hieroglyphs. And it has a lot to say about this. The evening sun must descend into the underworld to rejuvenate there and be born anew in the morning. This condition of weakness is exploited by humanity and the gods in Herculeopolis. Herculeopolis is the city in the vicinity of the entrance of the Fayum and is essentially a synonym for the revolt against the sun god. After the sun god rejuvenates himself and was reborn on the eastern horizon, his opponents attack him. This happens at the Island of the Flame. This Island of the Flame is a mystical place on the eastern horizon where the newborn god massacres his enemies daily, so the sky at the eastern horizon turns red. This red color could have resulted from the blood shed by the enemies, or, alternatively, from the flames that destroyed them. The battle is said to have occurred at Pa, which can mean place of the uprising or battleground. After this battle, Ra decides to draw back from the men and gods in the Nile Valley. He retreats to the Fayum and reaches it on the 23rd day of the first month of the season of inundation. This is the day when, as noted, the flood waters of the Nile reach the watershed of Hawara el Maktwa. Sure I pronounced that right. The Fayum is seen as an ideal retreat for the new sun god, since it also harbors the eight most ancient gods, his fathers and mothers. Here in the Fayum, he finds his new mother. We have here, then, a situation in the early morning. This stage is illustrated by a man in a box, which is visible at the left side of this picture of the lake. What looks like a man missing his legs is actually a representation of a man who is emerging from the water. His legs are not yet visible. This type of ephemeral representation is very unusual for gods in ancient Egypt, and the accompanying text makes the interpretation of this picture clear. Ra is the one who sets out to swim. Notice the hieroglyph for swim above the illustration. Here in the east of the lake is thus represented the morning birth of the sun god out of the water. Two pairs of primeval deities, each male partner with a frog's head and the females with snake heads, stand to either side of the birth out of the water. Combining the image of the great goddess Meheweret with this representation, we can infer that the sun god is born under the feet of the goddess. One could say that the god is born from the great flood. The rotation of the figure of the goddess produces the effect of the birth of the sun god occurring underneath his mother. The birth of the sun in the morning repeats the process of creation from the first time of creation all over again. Now, Holy Land, that is connected to not only the original gods but the great flood, is a good place to start when you're looking for a mythological labyrinth that's said to be just massive from an ancient lost civilization. And the deal here is, the Egyptian accounts, this is a late one. This is from the Ptolemaic period. This is from after the Greek occupation. This is when Egyptian culture was kind of eroding. So perhaps, you know, the account isn't exactly perfect, isn't exactly accurate. We have a lot of accounts, right? But we've also got one from this guy named Pliny the Boomer, Pliny the Elder, whatever you want to call him, all right? He was a lot more critical. He was a lot more cruel when he was looking at things. He was a lot more skeptical and downright mean-spirited at times. In Egypt, too, are the pyramids, which must be mentioned, if only cursorily. They rank as a superfluous and foolish display of wealth on the part of the kings, since it is generally recorded that the motive for building them was to avoid providing funds for their successors or for rivals who wished to plot against them, or else to keep the common folk occupied. Much vanity was shown by these kings in regard to such enterprises, and the remains of several unfinished pyramids are still in existence. The largest pyramid is made of stone from the Arabian quarries. It is said that 360,000 men took 20 years to build it. The time taken to build all three was 88 years and 4 months. The authors who have written about them, namely Herodotus, Ahasuerus, Doris of Samos, Aristarchus, Dionysus, Artemidemus, Alexander Polyurethane, Butyrodorus, Antihistamine, Demetrius, Demetalius, and Apron, are not all agreed as to which kings were responsible for their construction, since chance, with the greatest justice, has caused those who inspired such a mighty display of vanity to be forgotten. Some of the writers mentioned record that 1,600 talents were spent on radishes, garlic, and onions alone. The largest pyramid covers an area of nearly 7 irurigurga, which is 4 acres, I guess. Each of the four sides has an equal measurement from corner to corner of 783 feet. The height from ground level to the pinnacle amounts to 725 feet, while the circumference of the pinnacle is 164 feet. As for the second pyramid, each of its sides from corner to corner totals 7,574 feet. The third is smaller than those already mentioned, but on the other hand is far more splendid, with its Ethiopian stones towering to a height of 363 feet along its sloping sides between the corners. No traces of the building operations survive. All around, far and wide, there is merely sand shaped like lentils, such as is found in most of Africa. The crucial problem is to know how the masonry was laid to such a great height. Some think that ramps of soda and salt were piled against the structure as it was raised, and that after its completion these were flooded and dissolved by water from the river. Others hold that bridges were built of mud bricks, and when the work was finished, the bricks were allotted to individuals for building their own houses. For it is considered impossible that the Nile, flowing at a far lower level, could have flooded the site. We must mention also the labyrinths, quite the most abnormal achievement on which man has spent his resources, but by no means a fictitious one, as might well be supposed. One still exists in Egypt, in the Nome of Herculopolis. This, the first ever to be constructed, was built, according to tradition, 3,600 years ago, by King Petasuchus or King Tithios, although Herodotus attributes the whole work to the 12 kings, the last of whom was Psammathicus. Various reasons are suggested for its construction. Demoteli supposes it to have been the palace of Moteris, and Lysias the tomb of Morus, while many writers state that it was erected as a temple to the sun god, and that this is the general belief. Whatever the truth may be, there is no doubt that Daedalus adopted it as the model for the labyrinth built by him in Crete, but that he reproduced only a hundredth part of it, containing passages that wind, advance, and retreat in a bewilderingly intricate manner. It is not just a narrow strip of ground comprising many miles of walks or rides, such as we see exemplified in our tessellated floors or in the ceremonial games played by our boys in the Campus Martius, but doors are let into the walls at frequent intervals to suggest deceptively the way ahead and to force the visitor to go back upon the very same tracks he has already followed in his wanderings. This Cretan labyrinth was the next in succession after the Egyptian, and there was a third in Lemnos and a fourth in Italy, all alike being roofed with vaults of carefully worked stone. There is a feature of the Egyptian labyrinth for which I, for my part, find surprising, namely an entrance and columns made of Parian marble. The rest of the structure is of Syene granite, the great blocks of which have been laid in such a way that even the lapse of centuries cannot destroy them. Their preservation has been aided by the people of Herculeopolis, who have shown remarkable respect for an achievement that they detest. The ground plan and the individual parts of this building cannot be fully described because it is divided among the regions or administrative districts known as nomes, of which there are 21, each having a vast hall allotted to it by name. Besides these halls, it contains temples of all the Egyptian gods, and, furthermore, Nemesis placed within the 40 shrines several pyramids, each with a height of 40 cubits and an area at the base of 600 cubits square. It is when he is already exhausted with walking that the visitor reaches the bewildering maze of passages. Moreover, there are rooms and lofty upper stories reached by inclines, and porches from which flights of 90 stairs lead down to the ground. Inside are columns of imperial porphyry, images of gods, statues of kings, and figures of monsters. Some of the halls are laid out in such a way that when the doors are open there is a terrifying rumble of thunder within. Incidentally, most of the building has to be traversed in darkness. Again, there are other massive structures outside the wall of the labyrinth. The Greek term for these is pteron, or wing. Then there are other halls that have been made by digging galleries around. The few repairs that have been made were carried out by one man alone, Caramaron, the eunuch of King Nechotibus, 500 years before the time of Alexander the Great. There is a further tradition that he used beams of acacia boiled in oil to serve as supports while the square blocks of stone were being lifted into the vaults.
Now Pliny, in typical elder fashion, was all like, "You youngins are spending your bling on the wrong sorts of things," but whatever. At the end of the day, he gave us some good measurements and some good, potentially good, relaying of evidence or information from the Egyptians as to what he'd heard anyway about how the pyramids were built. Now, this isn't the only guy in the Egyptians and the Greeks and the Romans. There are so many of these types of accounts of either tunnels underneath the Giza Plateau or near Hawara or both or in other areas that I could be reading about that for quite a while. But there's other things to mention as well, and those are the big ones. So let's get into some of the, you know, medieval Arabian accounts. Now, most of the original sources are lost to history, but thankfully Al-Makrizi, an Egyptian historian who lived in the 14th and 15th centuries, made a point of recording several early accounts of what those people claimed to have seen in ancient Egypt. The most interesting to me comes from Ibn Wasif Shah al-Khabib, who left us this lengthy but amazing account.
The king then said, "Measure the elevation of the stars and see if something will happen." And they did their utmost in trying to get to the bottom of the matter and finally told him of the flood to come and a fire afterward that would issue out of the sign of Leo to consume most of the world. "See if that calamity will befall our country," the king then said. And they answered, "Yes, indeed, the flood will wipe out most of it, and it will suffer ruin that will last for several years." "Then see," said the king, "if it will prosper again as before, or whether it will remain submerged by water forever." They said, "No, the country will become again the way it was, and it will prosper." "Then what?" asked the king. "A king will invade," they replied, "who will kill its people and pillage its possessions." "Then what?" asked the king. "A misshapen people will invade it, coming from the direction of the mountain of the Nile, and will rule the greater part of it," they answered. "Then what?" asked the king. "Its Nile will run dry, and the country will become depopulated," they said. At that point, the king ordered the pyramids to be built and channels leading to them to be dug through, which the Nile could reach a specific place and then overflow to certain points in the land to the west and in Upper Egypt. And he had the pyramids filled with talismans, wondrous works, treasures, idols, and the bodies of the Egyptian kings. The priests he ordered to inscribe on them everything the ancient sages had said. On them and their ceilings and columns he had all the secret sciences recorded that the Egyptians lay claim to. He had the images of the stars painted there and the names of the medicinal drugs inscribed, together with their beneficial and their harmful properties, as well as the science of natural magic, the science of arithmetic and geometry, and all of their sciences in general, understandable to those who know their writings and their language. As he began with the construction of the pyramids, he had huge columns carved out, tremendous stone slabs laid out, lead mined in the land to the west, and boulders brought in from the area of Aswan. With these he built the foundations of the three pyramids, the eastern, the western, and the colored one. They had sheets with writing on them, and when a stone was cut and completely dressed, they would place those sheets on it and give it a push by which the stone was propelled forward over a distance of 100 sam. They kept repeating that until the stone reached the pyramids. 40 cubits below the ground, he had entrances to the pyramids made. The entrance to the eastern pyramid was on the east side, 100 cubits from the center of the pyramid wall. The entrance to the western pyramid on the west side, also 100 cubits from the center of the pyramid wall. And the entrance to the colored pyramid on the south side, likewise 100 cubits from the center of the pyramid wall. When one digs a distance of the above measurement, one reaches the vaulted passageway that was built as the entryway to the pyramid entrance. He made the height of each of the pyramids above the ground 100 cubits, measured by the royal cubit, which was their cubit, which corresponds to a height of 500 cubits in terms of our present-day cubit.
To interrupt really quick, the entrance is said to be about 40 cubits deep. The pyramid said to be 450 cubits tall. That's about an 8%. So that means that the entrance is about 36 feet deep. Okay, carry on.
The length of each on all four sides at the base, he also made 100 cubits in terms of their cubit. Then he had them shaped symmetrically on each side in such a way that their summits tapered off to a sharp point at a height of 300 cubits of our kind from each of the ends of the lateral base. The construction of the pyramids was begun under a lucky star on which they had reached an agreement and which they had carefully selected. And when they were finished, he had them draped from top to bottom in colored brocade and had a festival held in their honor, which was attended by all the people in his kingdom. Then he had 30 treasure vaults of colored granite made inside the western pyramid, and these were filled with rich treasures, with implements and statues made of precious stones, with tools made of first-rate iron, such as weapons that would not rust, with glass that could be folded without breaking, with strange talismans, with the various kinds of simple and compound drugs, and with lethal poisons. In the eastern pyramid, he had the various celestial domes and planets depicted, and also had statues erected, as his ancestors had created, and he had incense deposited there, which one offered up to the stars, and the books written on them. He had fixed stars represented, and that which happened in their periods time after time, and the epochs established with regards to them, and he had the events of the past recorded, and the times in which one expects future happenings, and the names of all the rulers of Egypt to the end of time. Moreover, he had ceremonial vessels set up containing medicinal potions and the like. In the colored pyramid, he had the bodies of the priests placed, in coffins made of black granite, and each priest had a book by his side that contained the record of his wondrous arts and deeds, his biography, what he had accomplished in his time, and what was and what will be from the beginning to the time of the end. Along the walls of each side he had idols placed, which performed with their hands all the arts, arranged according to their rank and power. There was also a description of every alchemical skill, of how to handle it, and of the things suitable for its practice. There was not a single science that he did not write down and record. Moreover, he had the treasures of the stars taken there, which had been offered up to them as gifts, and the treasures of the priests, a huge amount beyond counting.
Quite an intriguing story, right? I mean, like I said, this is pretty wild. I've read this account a few times. I mean, come on, he's got glass that you can fold and iron tools and celestial knowledge and all kinds of science and potions and poisons and just all manner of crazy, cool stuff that stands in stark contrast to the bare walls that we see when we look at those pyramids today. It almost makes you wonder if the idea of encoded knowledge with numerology or whatnot isn't somewhat accurate there. But at any rate,
Al-Makizi, I'm sure I pronounced that accurately. He's got a lot more things to say. It's a lot more people that he's got in his little book there.
Abu-ul-Hasan al-Mas'udi, I'm sure I pronounced that right, relates in his History of Time and of Those Eliminated by Its Reverses that when the Caliph Abdallah al-Mamun ibn Harun al-Rashid came to Egypt and visited the pyramids, he wanted to have one of them destroyed in order to find out what was inside of them. He was told, "This is not in your power," but he replied, "Some part of the pyramid simply must be opened." And so the breach, that is still open nowadays, was made for him by setting a fire to it and sprinkling vinegar on it and applying mattocks and blacksmiths toiling away, so that he spent a lot of money on the undertaking. They found out that the thickness of the wall was close to 20 cubits, and when they finally got to the end of the wall, they discovered behind the entrance tunnel a green receptacle containing gold coins, each dinar weighing 1 yukla. 37.5 grams, and the number of dinars coming to 1,000. Al-Mamun began to wonder about that gold and its excellent quality. Then he had his expenditures for making the breach added up, and they discovered that the gold they had found was no more and no less than what they had spent on its discovery. He was much astonished that those people had known how much he was going to spend and had left that exact equivalent in that place. The vessel in which the gold was found is said to have been made of chrysolite, and Al-Mamun had it taken to his treasuries. It was the last of Egypt's wonders to be moved away. For years, people kept visiting the pyramid and descending through the sloping shaft into its interior. Some of them came away unscathed, and some of them perished. Thus, 20 youngsters once agreed to enter the pyramid. Having provided themselves with the necessary food, drink, ropes, candles, etc., they went down through the shaft where they saw bats the size of eagles that struck their faces. Then they lowered one from their midst with ropes, when suddenly the ground closed above him. They tried to pull him up until they just could not go on any more. Then they heard a terrifying sound, and they all fainted. And after a while they came to and left the pyramid, and as they were sitting around, marveling at what had just happened to them, the ground suddenly spat out their companion, alive, right in front of their eyes. He said a few words they did not understand and dropped dead, and as they carried him away, they were picked up by the guards and taken to the governor. They told him their story, and when they asked him about the words their companion had said before he died, they were told that they meant, "This is a punishment for those who seek what is not theirs."
And here we have an account of the looting of Menkaure's pyramid, the gold found within, and the whippersnappers that pissed off the spirit gods that guard the place and started playing with underground passages. And this one, what's really interesting to me is that box that's peridot, basically. The coins weigh about 80 pounds total, and the largest piece of peridot that we know of that's unworked is 12 pounds. So a treasure chest that could hold 12 pounds of coin or 80 pounds of coins would be an absolute amazing treasure and would be the kind of thing that would end up on a rich guy's shelf somewhere and never to be spoken of again. I've discussed this sort of thing numerous times in the past, link right up there. And this is almost as intriguing as the notion that the pyramids were built to survive the floods, again from Al-Makizi.
In describing Egypt, Ibn Hakwal says, "And there are two pyramids, which are without peer on earth, either in the realm of the believers or in the realm of the infidels, the like of which has never been built, nor will ever be built." One of the Abbasids read on one of them, "I have built them. Let him who claims to be a powerful ruler destroy them, for destroying is easier than building." That person, I think it was Al-Mamun or Al-Mutasum, intended to do that, but it turned out that Egypt's tax revenue at the time was not sufficient for it. And yet, it came at the time, owing to the fairness with which the taxes were collected, and the serious desire on the part of the government to treat the subjects with kindness and justice, to 4,257,000 dinars, when the Nile reached 17 cubits and 10 fingers, at a tax rate of 2 dinars per fidan. So he desisted from the plan, and never said a word about it again. On the southern edge of Al-Fustat, on the west bank of the Nile, are numerous huge structures which spread out all over Upper Egypt and are called pyramids. But these are not like the two pyramids which stand opposite Al-Fustat at a distance of 2 parasangs from the city. Each of the latter has an altitude of 400 cubits and a width equal to its height, and they are built of tough stones, each stone from 10 to 8 cubits in height, length, and width, depending on whether a stone of larger or smaller size needed to be set down as required by the rules of their indigenous geometry, because they became more and more narrow toward the top until the summit of each is the size of the space for a camel to kneel down on. Their walls are covered with Greek writing. Some people have claimed that they are tombs, but that is not so. Rather, what prompted their builder to construct them was his certain knowledge that the flood would destroy everything on earth that was not protected by such structures. So he stored his treasures and possessions in them. Then came the flood, and after it had dried up, the contents of the two pyramids passed on to Bisar, the son of Misraim, son of Ham, son of Noah. One of the later kings used them to store his grain, but God alone knows the truth.
Ibn Hakwal visited Egypt around 955 AD, and it's interesting how different yet similar the Islamic accounts are to the Greek and Roman accounts. We still have these structures, these massive tunnels underneath, these mysteries and chambers, but instead of the bare walls that we see and spoken of in the Roman accounts, we hear these things spoken of with just massive amounts of treasures covering them and whatnot. It's very interesting to see how different these accounts become. And this is the kind of thing that I'll cover in a future video. We have statues flanking sarcophagi in the Great Pyramid that are spoken of, geometry used to make these statues, Hermes being one of the possible builders. I'll cover some of the Islamic legends surrounding the pyramids in a future video because they're just plain fun. But for now, I want to point out that the idea that they were built to survive the Great Flood wasn't some novel idea or anything. It seems to have been a very popular idea. From the Ibn Hakam, I'm so bad with these names, I'll put it on the screen.
I don't reckon that the pyramids were built except before the Great Flood, because if they were built afterwards, then there would be knowledge of them among the people.
This was the popular position for quite a long time, but that seems to have been lost in the Western mind for quite a while, up till nearly till the time of Napoleon. And when he shows up, things changed quite a bit. To quote from a German Egyptologist named Inge Unterhoven, man, I need to take a class on how to pronounce things worse because I'm like setting the bar so high for everybody else. But this is in her 2002 paper, A New Light on an Egyptian Labyrinth.
The exact location of the Egyptian labyrinth was forgotten after the collapse of Roman rule, but its ancient fame stimulated the first European travelers and excavators in Egypt to attempt to retrace it. Although various places in the Fayum Lake area were initially hypothetically identified as the site of the labyrinth, the identification with Hawara has been generally accepted since Sicard made this proposal at the end of the 17th century.
Now, Sicard was an early Frenchman on the scene about 100 years before the time of Napoleon, actually. And he listened closely to the locals and read enough books to be called a scholar and was well aware of the existence of the labyrinth. And he believed the stories to be true. And he wasn't the only Frenchman to believe this. In fact, it became a popular tale of the late 18th and 19th century. The tunnels near the Sphinx were found and stopped the investigations, and other tunnels had frustrated treasure-hunting efforts. Napoleon brought 160 scientists and scholars and whatnot with him and had them write Description de la Egypt, for those of you who don't like French, it was the description of Egypt, and it's the beginning of Egyptology. It is a pretty interesting book, but as you can imagine, it speaks about tunnels and underground passages. Mostly it focuses on the tunnels supposedly near and around the Sphinx, the top of the Sphinx's head, for example, but it also discusses looking for the labyrinth and whatnot. Again, to quote from that German lady, Hoke de Voorhees' 2002 paper,
from the 18th century onwards, excavators tried their luck at the labyrinth site at Hawara. In 1799 and 1800, Jamard and Caristi of the French expedition wrongly identified the mud brick walls north and west of the pyramid as the labyrinth. They attributed the imposing architectural remains south of the pyramid to a peristyle temple. The successive excavations of Lepsius, Vasali, and Petrie, however, proved that the large structure in the area south of the pyramid was the labyrinth. More recently, the Inspectorate of Fayum Antiquities carried out excavations in the labyrinth area in 1995 and 2000.
Now, the area they believed to be the labyrinth is considered to have been proven to be such by Sir Flender Petrie's excavations due to the large size of the region, and the first pyramid of Amenhet III was associated with the labyrinth in at least one report. But as we have seen, the reports are pretty consistent. This underground portion is supposed to be the most impressive part. This is the part that is... you can't quite believe that men could even make such a thing. So it does seem odd that they didn't find any of that. Now, Petrie looked at Hawara thanks to the works of Carl Richard Lepsius. His work was done in 1843, and it was the first large-scale excavations done in the Hawara region, and Lepsius believed that he had located the labyrinth. Like many after him, the areas that Lepsius excavated were not deep enough to actually qualify for the labyrinth as that was described in these legendary, mythological, or historical accounts, however you want to look at them. And in fact, some of the things he identified as being part of the labyrinth were actually Roman. It seems like the myths surrounding the labyrinths in ancient Egypt are a lot like the myths surrounding the pyramids. Neither seems to go away when cultural shifts come, and both are compelling enough to have gotten serious attention from Egyptologists. And then there's the scans we've gotten from our Italians. No, again, not those Italians. I mean Armando Fay and Filippo Bande, the men who run the COFRE research project, which is a synthetic aperture radar team which I mentioned earlier. Now, I've covered this before, as I mentioned, but I wanted to make sure that I had all the information accurate, so before I made this video, I reached out to Armando May and asked him, hey, do I got all my ducks in a row? And he gave me this exact quote.
The technology we use to convert SAR signals into vibration analysis, known as the Biondi protocol, is proprietary and officially registered in Malta. As for the 3D reconstructions, these are generally developed by Professor Malanga, who uses his own dedicated software. It is important to note that these 3D models are not to scale and are released publicly only for the purpose of providing simplified visual information to the general audience.
The vibration analysis is how they detect changes in the surface topography, and then they use AI to, you know, software to basically suss what that means going down underneath the soil from there. This is proprietary software, so it can't be peer-reviewed or replicated. So a lot of people are very skeptical of it, and I get why. However, the findings they're making are awe-inspiring. Tunnels crisscrossing the Giza Plateau. Pillars going down from the base of Khafre's pyramid for over a mile, with spiral staircases surrounding each pillar. And at Hawara, a massive underground network of tunnels going deep underground and covering about the same area the ruins Petrie found cover. Obviously, the claims that Armando and Felipe are making are more in line with the ancient accounts than modern Egyptology is. But again, their methods can't be replicated. So what we really have here is a interesting moment in history. And for those of you who've watched me a bunch of times, you know what's coming next. And for those of you who haven't watched me before, I apologize. But we really need more work done here. At this point, we have two very disparate positions that are both claiming to use scientific methods to make their findings. And again, it's one thing is very important to point out here, what Armando said specifically about the 3D reconstructions.
It is important to note that these 3D models are not to scale and are released publicly only for the purpose of providing simplified visual information to the general audience.
These images, they're not quite accurate. They're clickbait. This is not uncommon with this sort of thing. When I talked about the sunken city off the coast of Cuba, I show that image that's quite frequently used is also clickbait. It's not very accurate. It's exaggerated. It's idealistic. And sadly, you know, that's frustrating, but this is the day and age that we live in where even dumbasses like myself could benefit from making clickbaity type of things. So we have to be on the lookout for that sort of thing. And I appreciate that some of you out there are, you know, less skeptical than myself, but you don't get all pissed off when I point out that sometimes fucking people lie to us, man. It just sucks. But, you know, we got a lot of people that look into these things as well. Like, for example, you got me, you got Graham Hancock, you got Jimmy Corsetti, you got Randall Carlson, you got all kinds of other dudes, Hugh Newman, you got just all kinds of people out there. And, you know, I just met a bunch of these guys right down in Scottsdale, Arizona, just a few days ago, about a week ago. And I'm going to be seeing a bunch of these guys again here in a few more months, in May. They're going to be doing a thing in Sedona, it sounds like, and hopefully in Austin at the end of next year. And so pay attention, stay tuned. There'll be a link to a Worlds of View video. I'm the pronouncer of the pronunciation, guys. There's a link down below. If you click the fucking thing, you can find stuff to buy tickets to come and shake my hand and yell at me like other people do. Thank you guys so much. Love you. Have a great holiday season. I will try to get more out before Christmas. Take care.